with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Okay, good evening, everybody, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always, always been in you. Very happy new year to everyone, and I am delighted to be with you here this evening and every other Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I am Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I invite you to visit the website. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And if you would like to be part of the show, I would very much like to take your calls, but that number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I will be taking your calls after the break. And just a reminder that these broadcasts are podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can certainly go back into the archives and listen to previous shows. Now, for those of you who are tuning in for the very first time, I just want to say welcome aboard, welcome to the show. And just in case you are wondering exactly what is Reclaiming Authenticity, I just want to share with you on the outset that it's basically, you know, a focus on the integration of our spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of our relationships with ourselves, relationships that we have with others, and our relationship with God and/or the divine. Because, you know, it really doesn't matter when you come to think about it, you know, who we are or where we were born or into what family we were placed, because ours is a world just filled with relationships. In fact, we are social beings who often spend our lives trying to make sense out of our world by trying to find our place in the world. Now, we do not realize just how connected we are with others, in that the pain that we may inflict on others or we inflict on ourselves, and that we are bound by that pain. Well, likewise, the pain that others inflict on a group of people or individuals, they also are emotionally, psychologically, and spiritually bound by and through the pain they suffer as a result. And I'll say more about that boomerang effect, let's say. But, you know, we are social beings. We just cannot get around that. And sadly enough, it is often within the context of relationships that we experience tremendous pain and suffering, from overt acts of betrayal and cruelty that somebody has inflicted against us, or vice versa, to simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Many people bear the scars, even to this day, they bear the scars of the physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual woundedness. And yet, ironically, just as we experience our woundedness in relationships, it's also within the context of healthier relationships that we can find our healing, our voice, our authenticity. So the difficulty then is often finding the courage to discover that which has always been in you. You know, those gifts, those graces and skills, and our uniqueness that we come into the world with, It's a hachaetos. It's a thisness, as coined by John Duns Scotus, the Scottish Franciscan, somewhere around 1308. Because you see, I'm a firm believer that we all come into this world with everything we need for ourselves and for others. But through our various experiences, we may have been giving away parts of ourselves, if not the whole, of that uniqueness or that thisness. And the reason why we may have done this is perhaps we didn't feel as though we could live up to another person's expectation of us. Or perhaps we hid our uniqueness, our hachaetos, from others in order to survive abuses. Or maybe, perhaps those aspects of ourselves have been taken away from us, and we just simply did not have the strength to fight that, or to say, to prevent that. But at any rate, when we become aware that we have done these things, it does take tremendous courage to reclaim who we are. And we can reclaim our voice, our uniqueness, our thisness. As I explained to kids that I counsel, because they love that word hachaetos, and I just say, well, let's look at it as the thisness. I try to explain it to them in terms of a thumbprint. It's like everybody has a thumbprint, and yet no two thumbprints are alike. In other words, everybody has a thisness, but no two thisnesses or uniqueness is identical. And putting it into a broader context, let's say that you and I were given tasks to do, to either perform a certain job or complete a project or whatever it is that we're asked to do. And this is where our uniqueness, our thisness, comes in, because you will have your way of completing the tasks according to your thisness, and I have mine according to my thisness. It doesn't make it better, good, worse. It makes it different. It makes it unique. It makes it a product of our thisness. But when we do become aware of the painful things in our lives and we seek out healing for those things, it does take tremendous courage to reclaim who we are. Franklin Delano Roosevelt once said about courage that courage is not the absence of fear, but rather it is the assessment that something else is more important than fear. Or I'll share with you one of my favorite quotes from the American poet T.S. Eliot. He writes, "We shall not cease from exploration, and at the end of all of our exploring, will be arrived to where we started and know the place for the first time." In fact, there is so much more to us than what we have become so far, so much more than what we may even realize. And this is what reclaiming authenticity is all about, finding that courage to be able to reclaim that which has always been in you. In fact, being able to come to terms to claim who you have always been. So let 2024 be the year you reclaim more of your authentic voice and self. Well, I just wanted to start off today just by asking you a question of, you know, how is your heart today? As we stand at the beginning of a new year, I hope your heart is well. I hope you are well. I hope that if you are even struggling today, that you will be able to find the rest, the comfort, and the peace that you need. Again, Happy New Year. Welcome to 2024, and I hope that you're off to a good start, a good beginning. And we've just come from another holiday season, and you and I both know that where there are holidays, there are often family gatherings. And where there are family gatherings, there's often a lot of food Okay. Has anybody weighed themselves since the holidays are now over? Do we have the courage to do that? But at any rate, where there are family gatherings, there is often a lot of food. And when families gather to celebrate the holidays with food, what do we have? No, not a perfect storm. You know, I don't care who built, who burned what or who spilled what, but rather we have an opportunity to tell stories. We have an opportunity to tell family stories. Well, what's your New Year's traditions and your stories? Have you ever thought about that? Sometimes we just go through the motions and like, well, we do this every year. We don't give it any thought. This is just what we do, so on and so forth. But how far back do those traditions and family stories go? On my father's side, I came to appreciate the stories and the food from the German, Polish, and Hungarian perspective. And of course, when it was New Year's Day a couple days ago, you have to eat pork and sauerkraut with mashed potatoes. Okay, that's a standard. Okay, but does anybody else eat pork and sauerkraut with mashed potatoes? Anybody? Well, yeah, okay. You can also eat stuffed cabbage or pierogies on New Year's, but you have to have a generous helping of pork and sauerkraut with the mashed potatoes. Now, have you ever wondered why people eat pork and sauerkraut on New Year's Day? Well, it's simply because you want to start off the new year with as much luck as you can get. And this is steeped in the belief that because pigs are the only animal that root in the mud forward, therefore, you want to look forward and not backwards. Okay? Pigs root in the mud, but they root forward. And therefore, you want to look forward through 2024. And you don't want to look backwards, as some animals root backwards. Well, some people in the South might also eat a cold black-eyed peas salad, which is also very good if it's prepared properly. And others in the Deep South might enjoy king cake with a little baby figurine or ring inside the cake. And if you just happen to be the lucky individual that hopefully you don't bite into the little baby figurine or you don't bite into the ring, but you do find it, well, then that's the prize in and of itself. Now, in China and Japan and many other Asian countries, it is customary to eat noodles on New Year's Day. And among, you know, China and Japan and other Asian countries, the length of noodles symbolizes longevity. So, of course, the longer the noodle, the longer your life is. And elsewhere in Scandinavian countries, many people eat herring, which is considered a sign of good fortune for the whole year. So before we root forward into 2024, let's take a moment and reflect on 2023. What lessons have you learned this past year? What insights have you gained? What are some things you had to let go of, and what are the things do you really want to take hold of this year? You see, the interesting thing about reflecting on these questions is that they are often better understood and remembered within the context of stories. So, what is your all-time favorite story? You know, the one that you can sit and listen to, or even, let's say, sit and tell, over and over and over again, year after year after year. And we certainly have all of our favorites. I mean, perhaps when you were in school, you learned how to write a story, and you had to make sure, according to the teacher, that you included the what, the when, the where, the why, and the how, or who or was or is the storyteller in your family. Now, in my family, it is certainly me. And when our kids were much younger, instead of reading them a story, I would tell them a story at bedtime, which their minds would connect to with the imagery and so forth, and then they would get all wound up and they wouldn't be able to get it go to sleep afterwards. And then for some reason, I would get into trouble. So when you listen to or you read a story, what captures your attention? The mental images formed in your mind. What captures your attention? Is it the deeper lessons or the morals found in the storyline? Or perhaps it was the way in which the story was told that created an excitement or an enthusiasm. And, you know, this just might be the reason why Audible app is so popular. I mean, there's something so fascinating about hearing a story being read to us. I mean, this is something that I enjoyed, you know, as a young boy. I just was able to listen to the radio in my room, and I was fortunate enough to find a murder mystery station. And on under about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, they would come in with about a half hour, you know, these little half hour shows in which, you know, it was more like a whodunit. And of course, just laying in bed and just trying to figure it out, but hanging on every word that the narrator was talking about. And sometimes these broadcasts were animated. So you would hear the sound of like a crashing trash can or thunder, and you would, you know, you just feel the lightning in the background and so forth. And so it was very, very entertaining. And that's many times that's how I would often drift off to sleep, was just listening to these stories. So there is something so fascinating about hearing a story being read to us. And this was the whole premise behind the movie, The Reader. This is a movie that came out years and years ago, very, very popular. It was a book, and then it was later turned into a movie. And the story is set in post-World War II Germany as the country attempts to rebuild itself. And this is where the teenager Michael Berg meets Hannah Schmitz. She was a bus conductor and a much older woman. Now, despite their differences in age, the relationship was passionate, to say the least. But what makes their relationship so memorable is that she would often ask Michael to read to her. And at the time, he had no idea that she couldn't read. And so this, you know, hey, read me a story, goes on for some time. However, when Hannah abruptly moves away one day without informing Michael, he is confused. He's heartbroken. And yet years later, while studying law at the Heidelberg University, Michael is appalled to discover that Hannah is on trial for participating in a very heinous Nazi war crime. So if you haven't seen the movie or if you haven't read the book, I'm not going to give away the ending, but I invite you to enjoy this story. Well, back in April of 2020, NPR did a story entitled How Stories Connect and Persuade Us, Unleashing the Brain Power of Narrative. And according to this article, with the benefit of MRI scans, they were able to locate the many different areas of the brain and how those areas would light up when someone is listening to a story or a narrative. And not just the areas of the brain that are responsible for language processing, but other neurological circuits also lit up. For example, during, let's say, more emotional sections of a story, one study found that the neurons responsible for processing emotions, you know, that just came from the sounds, those places in the brain were activated. So as you hear a story unfold, your brain actually, you know, your brain waves actually start to synchronize with those of the storyteller. And again, another fascinating stories, another fascinating research about stories by Dr. Yuri Hassan, professor of psychology and neuroscience at Princeton. He found that as one person told a story and another person listened, they found that the greater the listener's comprehension, the more closely the brain wave patterns mirrored those of the storyteller, and the brain activity into people. So in other words, stories stick with us often because of the metaphors people use to tell the stories. Now, storytelling also helps with learning because stories are an easy way to remember, not just facts and figures, but also you get caught up in the emotion and the mental images as well. Now, organizational psychologist Peg Neuhauser found that the learning, which stems from a well-told story, is remembered more accurately and for far longer than learning simply that is derived from facts and figures. And psychologist Jerome Bruner's research also suggested that facts are 20 times more likely to be remembered if they're part of a story. And I can attest to this because I can remember the stories my history teacher told us back in eighth grade, even to this day. I mean, whether he was talking about the Revolutionary War or the Civil War, he would place us in the storylines. It was almost as if we were back there living, you know, just during the Revolutionary War, or a soldier on the battlefield during the Civil War, and so on and so forth. So let's bring all this that we've been talking about so far into the world of mental health. Storytelling is a powerful means of helping people find the healing and peace they are desperately searching for, because storytelling places their experiences within a context. It is how people find meaning and make sense out of what they've been through and or are going through presently. Because when you think about it, everybody I counsel has a story to tell. In fact, every person's life is a story worth telling. And every story worth telling is a story worth listening to. And I have listened to many stories told in sadness and pain through the metaphors that people used. I've also listened to stories told in heartbreak and anger. And I have listened to many stories told in the larger context of joy and hope and peace. And one of the more interesting aspects I've found is that when people tell their stories from a place of anger, they typically forget all the other good things that have occurred in their life. It's almost as if anger produces a form of amnesia, or at least selective amnesia. Think about that. All the good and wonderful experiences prior to what, let's say, fueled a person's anger have been forgotten. It's as if past emotional, psychological, physical, and spiritual woundedness is all that can be remembered in the heat of the moment. You see, when we get used to telling a story a certain way, we do tend to forget all of the other things that, let's say, have come before. It's almost as if it's been conveniently erased for that time being. But as we tell our story from a healthier place, this also allows others to connect to healthier places within themselves. But what allows us to make this shift? And is it just merely an emotional shift? Or is it a mental shift? Is it a physical shift? Is it a spiritual shift? Well, author Marianne Williamson states that we can actually tell how much we have healed from the past because we have forgotten the pain in the memory. Okay. So in other words, it's kind of ironic that as we tell stories from a place of wholeness, we forget the pain when the stories are told from that place of wholeness. And yet, when we tell our stories from a place of anger, we tend to forget all the good. Well, as I mentioned earlier, everybody has their authentic voice. And where there's a voice, there is sound. And of course, where there is sound, there is vibration. And this is where the healing occurs. This is where the shift occurs. When we change the voice, let's say, the voice of how we tell the story, we change the vibration. And ultimately, we change the energy. Now, as a counseling educator, a clinician, and even a pastoral professional, I'm often saddened by people's beliefs that when it comes to addressing their physical, emotional, even spiritual problems, they often consider themselves powerless and without a voice. And perhaps this is a result of never feeling valued or never being allowed to use their voice. But admittedly, many people are unable to perceive their insights and their strengths as if they cannot see themselves capable of healing, let alone achieving anything meaningful with their lives. Now, most of the time, people are content to live for brief moments of joy and celebration, marked off by transitional milestones of, let's say, baptism, marriages, birthdays, graduations, promotions, retirements, etc., etc. And furthermore, when it comes to wrestling with life's questions, many people are often overwhelmed, not only by the concept that the answers they seek often lie within themselves, but also the belief that inner freedom, peace, joy, and unconditional love are all too good to be true. In other words, that those things belong to somebody else. There's just no way that those things belong to me. But the human voice has the power because it carries with it the energy of its vibration. And this is perhaps why people who deny the truth can't tolerate those who mention the truth, or at least come and tell a story from a different perspective. And here's a good example of what I mean. One of the major psychosocial spiritual obstacles I run into when counseling others actually occurs when emotionally, or let's say psychologically, wounded people are genuinely frightened and immobilized by their potential for healing and inner growth. You see, failure is not the only thing people fear. They also fear the idea of finding inner peace and freedom, which can also be immobilizing because now I have to do something with that. And if I've never known that, even one bit in my life, will I recognize it? Can I trust myself to do something with that? How do you live that out on a daily basis? And I remember working with a woman whose husband died after 35 years of marriage. Indeed, she was truly grief-stricken and clearly struggling with severe, severe depression. And it took many, 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 many sessions together. As we continued to work together, the more of her story of pain and loss started to come out. However, there was one time in a session where we met when she started to get a glimpse of a healthier life. She started to see that potential in her unfold. And she immediately said to me, "Stop. I can't do this no more. Don't take away my grief. That's all I have." Now, I knew where a statement like that was coming from, and not that I could ever take away something that another person wasn't ready to let go of, but she would rather live in her grief and pain and sorrow than embrace the possibility that she could live a life, all the while being able to hold on to wonderful memories of her husband. In her mind, if she let go of her grief, she had nothing else. She had nothing else better to take on. And so as a result, her story remained the same. And so did her voice and her energy. Well, I would really love to hear, you know, how you have found healing through storytelling. So again, if you would like to call in, the number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after this break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Houck. Be back with you in 1 minute. Welcome back. I am Dr. James Houck, and you're listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Earlier in the broadcast, we have been talking about a different way to look at how we might find healing when another person wounds us emotionally, psychologically, physically, and even spiritually. And a key piece to our healing is for us to perhaps first seek to understand not only how people tell their stories, but also what must have happened in another person's life, you know, their own pain, their own suffering, their own sorrow that perpetuates their need to continue to wound others. Now, as I mentioned in the first half of the show, many people are unable to perceive their insights and strengths, as if they cannot see themselves capable of healing, let alone achieving anything meaningful with their lives. And I also said that most of the time, people are content to live for these brief moments of, say, joy and celebration, marked off by transitional milestones of baptisms and marriages and birthdays, graduations, promotions and retirements, and so forth. And how many people out there do you know, maybe even yourself, that you just love to work for the weekend? It's like, I can't wait for Friday to get here, TGIF. It's Friday, it might be payday, but your whole week, you're looking ahead to when you can stop working for a couple of days or whatever your work schedule is. Well, furthermore, that when it comes to really struggling with our life questions, you know, many people are often overwhelmed, not only by the concept that the answers they seek often are found within themselves, you know, reclaiming authenticity, finding the courage to look within. But there's also this belief that inner freedom and peace and joy and unconditional love are just simply all too good to be true, that these things belong to somebody else, that I just don't feel worthy enough to have those things, let alone be those things for others. But the human voice has the power because it carries with it the energy of its vibration. And this is true. Research has been done in this area many, many, many times. And, you know, this is perhaps why people who let's say, deny the truth. They just simply cannot stand those who, let's say, expose the truth or even talk about the truth or at least come with a different perspective. It's almost as if you've kicked over a rock and just that light is just permeating everything. Okay? And as I had mentioned, I'll say this again, because this is a very, very good point, that one of the major psychosocial spiritual obstacles that I run into when counseling people, especially when they're struggling with their emotionally or psychologically wounds, that they are genuinely frightened and they are genuinely immobilized by their potential for healing and inner growth. And this is the work that I really do. I'll share with you this. It's like I share with people as they're telling me their stories, I point out the potential that they have to be able to heal from, you know, this woundedness that they carry around and this potential that they have to be able to grow emotionally, mature, and so on and so forth. But unfortunately, a lot of people suffer from a fear of failure. And a lot of people also suffer from fear of success. Because if I'm actually able to achieve things I want to, now what does that require of me? So the idea of finding inner peace and freedom can also be immobilizing to many, many people. And this is something that we have to certainly ask ourselves, that what has so wounded us that allows us to continuously act out of our own woundedness in relationships, but then at the same time expect different results? Well, I wish things would be better in my relationship, but I keep treating people like dirt. And we don't realize that out of our wounds, we wound people. So hurt people hurt people. Wounded people wound people. And we get to a point in our lives and we become baffled and like, why don't I heal? Well, in a debate with William F. Buckley at Cambridge University, James Baldwin, who was a writer, a playwright, a poet, and an activist, he made this remark. He says, "Now, Sheriff Clark in Selma, Alabama, cannot be dismissed as a total monster. I'm sure he loves his wife. I'm sure he loves his children. And maybe even he may like to get drunk. And one has to assume that he is a man just like me. But he does not know what drives him to use a club or to menace with the gun and to use a cattle prod. Something awful must have happened to a human being to be able to put a cattle prod against a woman's breast. Because you see, what happens to the woman is ghastly. What happens to the man who does it is in some ways much, much worse." Now, this debate is on YouTube, and all you have to do is just William F. Buckley and James Baldwin, Cambridge University debate, and it'll come right up. It's in black and white. And, you know, but more importantly, what James Baldwin is reminding us is that an offender and an oppressor suffer from a greater tragedy of inner pain than perhaps the one who suffers outwardly. And we don't have to look too far. You know, our news seems to be filled with similar stories, that what drives people to do this, what happened in their lives that has brought them to the point where they can justify inflicting horrific pain and immense suffering on somebody else and then walk away as if, no big deal. You know, it's just another day. You know, what has happened to a person that allows them to do that? What pain have they suffered? Well, this is a phenomenon I run into time and again, counseling clients who want to heal from their past, and they certainly want to improve their relationships. And whatever a person is struggling with from other relationships, more than likely is struggling with the same issue in themselves. And that's just something that I often use the analogy of, like, let me hold a mirror up to you. So whatever you're struggling with in your current relationships, more than likely, you're also personally struggling with this in yourself. So in other words, what negative energy are you sending out? Because whatever the negative energy is being sent out, that negative energy will, metaphorically speaking, echo back sooner or later. However, when we can change the voice, we change the vibration, we change the energy, and that is healing. And I propose that understanding self-inflicted wounds are like the vibration of an echo, that the negative energy of what we send out through our thoughts, through our words, through our actions, will return to us, just like we hear the sound of our own voice echoing back in our ears when we're in a tunnel or a cave. And this energy, and unless we transform that energy through healing our own wounds, it will come back to us exactly how it went out from us. And as we all explore our memories, we often catch a glimpse of what healing and wholeness might look for us. And this is not a bad thing. This is a very good thing, because when this insight occurs, we may be tempted to resist change. We may be tempted to run away from this transformation. We even may be tempted to sabotage ourselves by falling back into the old ways in order to avoid embracing what a thorough healing now requires of us. It may be, you know, calling us to acknowledge a wrongdoing, or asking for and receiving forgiveness, letting go of bitterness, letting go of resentment, taking responsibility, living in gratitude, and so on and so forth. Well, during these winter months, if you love to curl up with a good book, may I recommend The Wounded Healer by Henry Nouwen. In it, he states that people, somewhere around 74% people, are often compelled to go into helping professions, okay, because they understand themselves as being wounded. And I'm going to take this one step further and say that people not only see themselves as wounded, but also they know the power of transformative healing that takes place in themselves and its effects on the rest of humanity. Let me say that again, that people not only see themselves as wounded, but also they know firsthand, they've experienced the power of transformative healing that has taken place in themselves, as well as they see the effects on the rest of humanity. So it's true on one hand that hurt people and wounded people wound others, but healed people heal people. People who know they are loved unconditionally love others unconditionally. People who have tasted firsthand a tremendous peace and bliss, they know how to pass it on to others. They know how to show it. They know how to speak it. They know how to live it. In fact, this is where the understanding of the Hindi greeting, namaste, comes from. You know, in just a basic definition, namaste means the light or God in me recognizes or acknowledges the light and God in you. Or as I've shared with my India friends, because I'm able to see and know the oneness I have with the light and God in me, this enables me to see and know the light and God in others. And this is whether or not they see it in themselves. But because I'm able to see and know the oneness I have with the light and God, this enables me to see and know the light and God in others. But still, looking to others for approval and self-worth appears to be a natural part of developing a sense of, well, exactly who am I? In fact, this behavior is often how we first learn about ourselves and others in the world. And growing up, families, teachers, and other early childhood authority figures kind of reflect their own views and mirror these perceptions back to us. So, for example, long before we could form words, we are skilled at reading facial prompts and seeing or sensing another's approval or disapproval, or recognizing tones of love and laughter, or anger and contempt, distinguishing between a loving touch or a cold detachment, and learning every other emotion in between. So, moreover, sometime around 3 months of age, we begin to engage in a face-to-face interaction with our caregivers. It's a social referencing, as it were. And as infants, we display visual, facial, and vocal behaviors in response to how we are being treated through a kind of a give-and-take exchange between ourselves and others, typically to help us understand different situations. It's a learning process. And yet, ironically, we hold these initial interactions in ourselves physically first. We hold these feelings and this mirroring physically as we've developed a sense of trust or safety, or maybe we've developed a sense of suspicion or distrust. Because from these early stages of infancy, we've learned to regulate our affect, our emotions, as we took our social cues from people around us. In other words, how to express our feelings appropriately, as well as when and where such emotions are to be displayed, either at work, or how are we when we're at play, or when do we express our feelings at school or family celebrations or even funerals or whatever the context is? And as we physically and emotionally mature, we must learn to become less dependent on others for this, let's say, directional affirmation, and replace it with an internalized or individual sense of who we are. So in other words, instead of looking externally to get what we need, in terms of approval and acceptance, we now look within to find such qualities, that is, resiliency, peace, self-love, and so forth. And nevertheless, let's also keep in mind here that just as we initially look to others for our sense of affirmation and belonging and acceptance, so too are others looking to us to receive their sense of affirmation, belonging, and acceptance. Now, at first glance, this exchange, let's say, appears to be mutually beneficial. However, it can also lead to codependency in all our relationships. And just briefly here, codependency is typically seen in unhealthy relationships, whereby one person supports or enables another person's addiction, or poor mental health, or emotional immaturity, or irresponsibility in one's behaviors, or let's say insecurity or underachievement, to name a few. And perhaps the most common theme in codependency is this excessive reliance on others for one's approval and sense of identity. So in plain terms, I don't know who I am, so I have to look to somebody else to be able to define me. And I am going to follow their definition of who they want me to be for them, because I don't know who I am apart from that. Okay, do you understand the difference? So seeing the previous hurts and pain, etc., in another, or understanding why a person is the way they are, and seeing and understanding their history of events or circumstances that may have shaped them and filled them with fear and pain and bitterness can move us to forgive them more easily and help them begin their process of telling their stories differently. Even when an opportunity to forgive and reconcile with one who's caused us great pain and suffering, or vice versa, is presented, because bitterness has so entangled our soul, or something that we've allowed to entangle our soul, it's often impossible to let go of the pain. Because maybe deep inside of us, we might even believe that to let go of bitterness is clearly a sign of weakness. But all in all, sometimes both the victim and the survivor and offenders cannot envision taking hold of something better. It's just too vulnerable place for them to go. Now, although each person walks his or her own path in this life, embracing forgiveness and healing and grace and love occurs as each person is ready. Nobody can do this for another person, because the door of healing can be shown, but you certainly must turn the key and walk through yourself. You see, most of the time there is a strong connection between this perception of fear of change and perceived powerlessness, and a lifetime of struggling with self-loathing and low to no self-esteem. And through various hurtful experiences, people have internalized society's definition that say that they're dirty or worthless, or that they have no voice, or that they are dispensable, or they're no good, they're backward, and they will amount to nothing. And although it's difficult to say when people started to internalize such messages, it's often perhaps easier to pinpoint from whom these messages came. Because maybe you've heard of such things from your parents. Maybe you heard them from your teachers. Maybe you heard them from your friends, or perhaps these messages were even reinforced by society's prejudices. And this understanding has a profound impact for beginning the healing process of forgiving ourselves and forgiving one another. And it is this understanding that is based on a larger model of restorative justice. I don't know if you are familiar with when apartheid was abolished in South Africa, there was this Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It was established by then President Nelson Mandela in 1994. And the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was chaired at that time by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. And the victims and survivors gave their testimonies about human rights violations that they suffered under apartheid between somewhere between 1960 and 1994. And the perpetrators of such crimes under apartheid rule were also allowed to testify about their abusive activities and requested amnesty from any civil or criminal prosecution if they could only prove that they were simply following orders at the time. Now, although the stories that were told were often very painful to hear and recount, the purpose of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of South Africa was twofold. One, it was designed to follow this model of restorative justice, which focused on the needs of the victims and offenders and the community, rather than, let's say, retributive justice, where the response to a crime is proportionate to the punishment. And this was something that people had seen in the Nuremberg trials. So very, very effective. So again, Both sides can find forgiveness, healing, and restoration, but it must begin with someone. And perhaps that someone is you. Everybody has an authentic voice. And where there is a voice, there is sound. And of course, where there is sound, there is vibration. And this is where healing occurs. We change the voice, we change the vibration, and ultimately, we change the energy. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. It is true. There is so much more to us than what we have become so far, much more than we even realize. And this is exactly what Reclaiming Authenticity is all about. Finding that courage to reclaim that which has always been in you and who you have always been. So let 2024 be the year you reclaim more of your authentic voice and self. Namaste.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding around to buy a book by Dr. Houck. It's all there. Just wander over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 6 p.m. Pacific, on BBS Radio TV.